Welcome to the Compliance Perspectives Podcast. I'm Adam Turteltaub from the Society of Corporate Compliance and Ethics and Healthcare Compliance Association. Today I'm coming to you from Washington, D.C. in the office of Michael Horowitz. Michael was sworn in as Inspector General at the U.S. Department of Justice on April 16, 2012. Since then, he's had quite a busy time, to say the least. He's led several extremely high-profile internal investigations, including the recent review of the FBI's handling of the Clinton email investigation, and earlier, the Fast and Furious case. He's also led several investigations as part of his career as an outside counsel to Fortune 500 companies. Since 2015, he's also simultaneously served as the chair of the Council of the Inspector Generals on Integrity and Efficiency, an organization comprised of all 73 federal inspectors general. Michael's also a former member of the advisory board of the SEC, and we've been fortunate to have him speak many times at our meetings. And I've had the pleasure of knowing Michael since I think about 2002 or something like that. Now, before we begin, we want to make one thing clear. If you're listening to this podcast hoping for some juicy bits of information about the Clinton email investigation or any of the other IG's investigations, you will be disappointed. Our goal today is to take a look at the investigations he has led from the perspective of a compliance officer and to benefit from his experience conducting large-scale, high-profile investigations. Our goal is really to help corporate compliance officers, internal auditors, fraud examiners, and others who are charged with conducting investigation learn from his deep experience. First of all, Michael, thanks so much for talking to us and taking the time.
It's great to be here.
So let's dive in first with some definitional conversation. It would be helpful to have an overview of the IG's role, what it is, what it isn't.
So Inspector General oversees the agency that they're in, for me, the Department of Justice. And our job is to be the independent oversight of the department. We're not management. We don't set policy. We're not a substitute for the department having its own oversight of its programs and making sure that it's effectively running as management its programs. We're there to conduct that independent oversight, to be the eyes and ears for the taxpayers, for the public, on how programs are operating. Are they operating effectively and efficiently? Or is there waste, fraud, abuse, mismanagement in how the department's running? That's really our job.
And that would explain, by the way, why people know you from the high profile stuff. But, you know, looking at your reports day to day, you're dealing with a lot of issues of financial mismanagement and other sort of day to day things that a typical compliance officer would likely face.
That's right. We're an amalgam of compliance responsibilities, internal audit responsibilities, and investigative responsibilities. And so, for example, my office issues 70 to 80 audits per year of various programs, both internally, the department, how it's running its programs, but also when the department gives out grants or enters into contracts, we look at those and we audit those as well.
And one thing for clarity's sake, you deal with the Department of Justice, I think the Bureau of Prisons too?
Right. So that within the Department of Justice includes the Federal Bureau of Prisons, so the federal prison system, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the Drug Enforcement Administration, the U.S. Marshals Service, Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, as well as all the other various components of the department, including the three grant-making agencies of the department, which each year give out now about $5 billion a year in grants.
Okay, and the FBI too.
Including the FBI.
Right. Okay. So now, to put things in compliance people's terms, compliance folks do the seven elements plus risk of a program. How much of your mandate overlaps theirs, would you say?
We are very much similar in that regard in terms of what we're doing. We're all about going in and finding how programs are being run, making recommendations, ensuring that management is effectively managing the program, that they have appropriate standards, procedures, controls in place. And then what we do is we make recommendations at the end of our audits or reviews as to how they can improve them. And then we do follow-up to make sure they're doing it. So if you look at the seven standards, we're making sure they have policies and procedures that they're following. We're making sure that they are effectively managing the program from a management standpoint, as opposed to our independent oversight. We're making sure that they have appropriate systems in place to understand how their programs are operating and individuals can report wrongdoing either within the organization or to us through our hotline. Making sure they are educating their employees. We want to make sure they are doing what they should be doing there. And as I said, making sure that they are taking corrective action to fix problems that either they've identified or in our audits or reviews we've identified.
Okay, great. So now when it comes to conducting an investigation, do you have the sole say in whether one is done or can others require you to do it?
So our the Inspector General Act gives us complete independence to decide what audits, investigations, or reviews to conduct. No one can tell us what to start. No one can tell us what not to do, with an exception, which is the Attorney General, with notice to Congress, can prevent us from proceeding on an audit, review, or investigation if he makes a determination that us doing that work would impact national security, law enforcement, things like that. It is rarely done. In fact, in our 30-year history, it's been done once and only temporarily so that an informant wasn't harmed while our report or audit was issued. But we then subsequently released it once that harm dissipated. So in practical, for practical purposes, no one can tell us what to do or not do. We can, however, and do, however, reach out to management, much like a compliance officer would want to keep in touch with business leaders, to understand that we're here and that used effectively, we can be helpful to various parts of the department to help them improve their programs, that our work can be of assistance. We also remain in contact with Congress because Congress obviously is appropriating the money for these programs and is conducting oversight of these programs. And then we hear from the public and consider their requests for the kinds of reviews or audits they think we should be looking at or doing.
So like a compliance officer, just with many more potential masters and ideas for doing things. So before we go on, it might be good if you could give people a sense of where they can find out more information in general about what the IGs do and what both in terms of the job and some of their reporting.
Well, one of the great innovations that we've made in the IG community was last October 1, we launched a new webpage called oversight.gov. People can find now in one place all 73 IG reports that have been publicly issued. Obviously, classified reports won't be there, but if someone wants to go there, there's a webpage that keeps all IG reports. If they want to search and look for particular topics or issues, they can find them there. There's a search function. And if they want to join our Twitter feed and get regular report or learn about reports as they're issued, they can go to @oversight.gov, one word, sign up, and follow us through our work.
And I have to say, I follow that tweet, and it is amazing how many reports get issued.
Yeah.
What initial steps would you recommend an internal investigator take in planning an investigation into allegations of serious misconduct by senior management personnel, and notably those above your pay grade?
Right.
I mean, you're talking about when you've got to look at something that's going on the highest of high, what do you need to think about as whether it's you or as a compliance officer going in to make sure you do this right?
So one of the first things we do is, unless it's clear there's an issue that we have to investigate, we'll often want to kick the tires on the allegation first to make sure we're not being brought into a policy dispute, which isn't something we look at, a political fight, not anything we would get involved in, someone who has an axe to grind. So I think that's always a good first step to make sure your compliance function, independent oversight function, isn't being used for an ulterior purpose. It might be, and you may still have to do it, but at least going in with your eyes open as to what's going on there. And that's something we like to do before we just dive into a review, an audit, or investigation. The other thing that we do is, and I did this in connection with the election review, is speak with our stakeholders before we announce what we're going to do to understand what's the scope of expectations of people from their side, from our stakeholder side, and then allow us to explain to them what we actually are going to be doing. So the expectations are managed at the outset. As we've noted in our public statements, and I know this from working with compliance officers, that can change over time as you learn new information. It could broaden, it could shrink in scope. But I think going in, and having stakeholders understand what you're looking at and what you intend to do at the end in terms of reporting out is very important. And that's something we do with all the different stakeholders, including with the leadership of the department. We're not here to play gotcha. We're not looking to surprise people and catch them unaware. We're looking to do a thorough, fulsome investigation, but doing that in an above board way that's perceived and is in fact fair is very important.
And one thing to clarify, I think going back to something you mentioned that, you know, as you said, you want to make sure this isn't political. I think it's notable to point out that the Inspector General, although you're appointed by a president who is of one party or another, traditionally those jobs don't flip with each administration.
That's correct. In fact, under the IG Act, under the law creating the IGs, we have no term of years precisely for that purpose. So the IGs have traditionally not been changed during administrations. In fact, the only time it occurred was 36 years ago at the start of the Reagan administration, which was the first transition after the law was passed. There was an uproar about it, and President Reagan rehired many of the IGs because of that concern. And that established the principle of they shouldn't change with administration.
And but the president, I think you explained to me once, can fire an IG but has to report it to Congress?
Right. So the statute provides that the president can remove an IG, but they have to provide 30 days notice to Congress in advance of removal and explain why they're removing the IG.
Okay, great. All right, so let's get back to the question of the investigations and the scope. You know, one of the things you said is you want to set the scope of the investigation sort of based on not what the finding is, but what the outcome is. What piece of truth do you want to uncover?
Right. It's important to understand in terms of scope. First of all, what is the competency of the organization to do that kind of work? And that may seem obvious, but I think understanding what you're expected to do as an organization and what clearly you're not expected to do and laying that out. Because not everybody's familiar, certainly in the public, with inspectors general and what we do and what we don't do. But also, very clearly as you're scoping it out, making sure that you have in mind what questions at the end people expect to be answered by the report you're writing. Doing a review like this and then putting out a product that doesn't answer the questions people care about, or if you're in a compliance organization, the business unit leaders care about, you've just spent all that time with your limited resources reporting on something that isn't going to have any impact. We talk about that a lot in our organization. Making sure we're doing impactful work that matters to policymakers. In our case, it could be people in the department, could be people in the Hill, could be the public, could be the press, not NGOs out there, but thinking about what's going to have an impact in improving the operations of the Department of Justice.
That's interesting. And I got to say, what's funny is, as simple as it is, it's a good practical tip is to begin every investigation with a list of questions you want to answer and make sure you keep that sort of on the wall in front of you when you're faced, once you get into it and everything is happening. So usually when there's, obviously in your case, when you're dealing with a high profile investigation, it's everywhere. Congress is talking about it. The administration is talking about it. The press is talking about it. You're in a company, it may or may not be that public. You know, right. You're in a high profile investigation that's on the front page of the New York Times because the CEO did something. It's a fantastic allegation that happens. But most organizations, it may not be in the popular mind, but around the office, everyone is buzzing about it and is creating a larger storm. That has the potential to be very distracting because you're sitting there, you know, I would imagine, looking at all these other people wanting to know this, that, the other thing, and knowing as you walk through the halls, people are looking at you and wondering where he's going now, and or members of your team. How do you stay on task when the investigation ends up getting caught up in a lot of other things?
I think it's very important from the outset to speak to the team that's doing the work. And this is true, by the way, whether it's high profile or low profile or more routine, have an understanding of what you expect your timing to be. Again, what you expect the questions or the areas to be addressed are. But then making sure that you're not distracted by the issue of the day or the problem of the day. And you have to understand, obviously, some issues may well be the issue of the day that's important, that does cause you to expand the scope or change the scope of your work. But I think the way to do it is to regularly engage with the team that's doing the work, talk it through with them, understand what it is that's being asked of you, but being able to assess relatively quickly what's just a collateral sort of issue floating out there that is for others to worry about and what's yours.
Or another later investigation.
Or a subsequent investigation. We actually do talk about that often in our work, which is we just found another issue. Do we try and expand what we are doing to cover that? Or do we say, you know what, let's finish what we've got. Then we'll pick up the next one if it looks like at the end that's worth picking up. Because particularly in today's world, things change rapidly. What is relevant to the organization today in 6 months may have been overtaken by events, the business unit, or in our case, the political issue or the policy issue may be different. People's attention spans change. The issue of the day becomes a different issue. And so in many respects, the value of not jumping in immediately becomes apparent as you start seeing these problems arise.
So patience is a virtue here as well.
I think it's actually very important for a compliance officer to keep that in mind, because we all have this tendency to want to jump right in right away.
So are there any good rules of thumb for preventing sort of mission creep? I mean, other than, you know, one that you said is great, is this something we need to know now, or is this something that's its own barrel that has to be explored later? And asking that question, anything else that's good as people are going along?
I think what you need to do in part, and I try and do it here, is who's ever the team leader for the team, myself as the inspector general, the chief compliance officer and the equivalent organization, those are the people who should be sitting down and thinking about these issues. The team should be out there doing the work day to day and not having to worry that these are going to be thrown in their lane every day to sort out, you know, issue from non-issue. I think that's an important role for the leaders, the team leader, the chief compliance officer / IG to play, is you're the one who's there to run interference for the team. Mm-hmm. Let the team keep their eye on the ball. If there's an issue that could distract, you take it under account and deal with it.
So now, as you're going through the investigation, there's a lot of documents involved. I think in the Clinton, the FBI
Over
investigation.
Over a million, two plus.
Right, you have 1.2 million. Hopefully, most compliance officers don't have to deal with quite that many.
And hopefully we don't.
Right, hopefully you never have to go through that many again. What's the best way to make sure all that evidence is collected and, most importantly, safeguarded?
Well, I think it's always a challenge in collecting evidence. As I learned in working with compliance officers, and here, you don't know what you don't know going into it, right? You've gotten the basics and trying to figure out where the documents are, who's got them, who's relevant, because obviously one of the most important things is early on, trying to collect as much as you can as early as you can to make sure documents, particularly if it turns out there's a problem, that documents aren't lost either intentionally or more often unintentionally because of retention periods kicking in, other things coming up, people leaving their jobs, things happen, computers getting recycled. Very important to get the evidence as early as you can get it, which means identifying whose evidence do you need to collect. And in many respects, and this can be a challenge, you don't want to overcollect, but sometimes initially, depending upon the nature of it, you might have to overcollect. And then sort out once you make sure you've secured things to figure out what it is you need. So one of the things we do, for example, is we'll immediately get out notice, even if we haven't taken the documents ourselves, we've let the organization that we're overseeing, FBI, BO, Federal Bureau of Prisons, remember, we need these documents. turn off whatever automatic deletion programs you may have for these people or these matters, or take this laptop into custody. We don't need it yet, but we don't want it being overwritten. Things like that. I think that's very important, is right away understanding what the documents are, what you may need, and how you're going to secure them, whether you're going to take them yourselves, or if you're comfortable with the component that you're overseeing or the person you're overseeing, keep them secure.
Keep them secure. And that document retention stuff is an important one, because so many organizations at this point have software that just automatically deletes the emails after a certain period
right.
of time, and that's a bit of a disaster.
And if you're on a 3-year, you know, reuse cycle on your laptops, 4-year cycle, you may not have heard the allegation for a year or two in, and people may be coming up on their laptop exchange.
Right.
Right.
It could even be the next day.
It could be the next
day. Timing.
Right.
So, and then those just go wherever they all go.
And they get wiped.
Yeah. Now, you talked about, you know, you've got to figure out ultimately what is and isn't relevant. Email is brutal in that regards, I imagine,
right.
because there's so much of it. People, all the yes, no, back, forth, okay, bye. You know, it's
right.
yet another document to go through. And then there's other documents as well. How do you best get to the ones that are relevant? How do you find the needles you want to find in a haystack? I mean, I know there's software that can help, but
right.
is there other things as well? Because again, not every organization is going to be able to hire a big forensic data firm.
Right, and we can't afford that either. And so we are largely relying on our people to use search terms against information, or to provide the FBI, for example, with search terms so that we can collect information. And then what we tend to do is, as we start looking at those documents initially, we then start assessing whether we need to get the entirety of people's emails for a period of time sent to us, or, as our most recent report demonstrated, text messages for a period of time. We will then collect everything at that point if it looks like those are particularly hot documents that maybe we need to think much beyond, broader than just search terms, and maybe have to go through everything. Or the search terms will evolve over time and need more. So we're largely doing it with software programs to manage the data, but usually doing it manually through what we're learning as the investigation's going on, and then going back to further filter those documents and look at those documents. Because the other thing that inevitably happens, the more you look at emails, the more you find out, or you're likely to find out, there are other issues out there,
mm-hmm.
right? We've had occasions where you look at one allegation and you end up finding harassment issues, or people surfing the web for pornography, or doing other things that are inappropriate. And so that's the other thing that comes with looking at large-scale amounts of documents.
Don't know. And then these days, obviously, as has been talked about, it's not just email and text message, it's Snapchat, it's WeChat, it's a gazillion other things, some of which is not accessible because
Correct.
It's built to be self-destructive.
Or you find is, you know, we've had on occasion where you get somebody's cell phone and they have an app on it that encrypts and deletes messages right away. And
mm-hmm.
then you're into asking them, why do you have that? And what are you using it for? And who are you sending them to? And how did you get that, right? There, what happens as you start going down these roads, particularly in today's world, is you end up dealing with the question of mission creep, and is this something you start looking at?
Right. Scary, complicated.
Right.
I'm glad you do this job and not me. Also, as part of the investigation, you need to have the cooperation of a lot of people who aren't implicated, who
right.
might have seen something in the course of their job. They processed an invoice, they whatever, or been in a room. How do you secure their cooperation? Because a lot of them probably just don't want to say anything bad about anyone, or just don't want to be dragged into this. And then we'll talk about, well, let's start with that, and then I want to move on to sort of the flip side of that.
Right. So when we're doing non-criminal investigations, DOJ employees have an obligation to cooperate with the IG office. So we have people who have no choice if we want to compel them to sit with us. Most people do it voluntarily. We don't have to compel them. But people who are no longer with the organization, who've retired, moved to a new job, or never were with the organization, it's off, again, unless it's criminal and we have grand jury subpoena authority, purely voluntary. And so one of the keys, obviously, is to let people know, this is important, let people know their situation, which we do. If they're a witness, explain to them they're a witness, explain to them why we've concluded they're a witness if need be, have that engagement with them. And I think in many ways, when you are interviewing people, starting out with broader questions. I think if people are there, they're probably there because they're willing at some level, maybe initially not fully willing, to tell something of what they know. And the trick is, I think, as an interrogator, questioner, interviewer, is in the first instance making people feel comfortable. And in part, that's by listening and letting other people talk. Ask a relevant question that's open-ended and see where they're going. And I think you can pretty quickly learn when and understand if you're looking at and listening to an interviewee rather than talking over them, what their mindset is as they sit there, whether they're holding something back because they've got an issue, whether they're just nervous, whether they're worried about a friend. Usually people give signals like that when they're talking to you.
Interesting. And then let's deal with the flip side. You know, sometimes, and it doesn't have to be a political thing, it can be in a company, you've got agenda-driven witnesses.
Right.
Somebody doesn't like Bob and never did. Somebody's thought the company shouldn't, somebody's got something out for it, or somebody thinks they're more virtuous than the company is and the company shouldn't have been doing this business in the first place. When it comes to people like that, what's the best way to interview them and get the information you need and filter through what's agenda driven?
So I often talk with our folks because about this, because that's an issue that comes up a lot. You get people say, well, that person's got an agenda. They're here because they don't like the person we're investigating. You know, and I often talk with people, I said, you know what? I was an AUSA, federal prosecutor working with agents. You did a street crime case or a drug case. Someone came in as a cooperator who was a drug dealer. You signed them up to a cooperation agreement. You didn't disqualify that person as a witness simply because they wanted to reduce their jail sentence. You listened to them. You had a healthy skepticism. You understood their motivation. And I think it's the same way with a witness coming in who maybe does have a motivation that you know of or suspect. I think it's very important to not tip your hand to that idea to the witness, because that's a great way of turning off a witness. I think it's very important to let the witness, again, tell the story, and often either through your more subtle questioning or towards the end when you've gotten what you need to then start exploring the bias or concerns about bias that you have about the witness. But I think it's very important to let people give you their recollections, separate fact from opinion as they're speaking, make sure you understand and appreciate and, you know, go forward appropriately given those distinctions. But I think you let people come in, tell their story, hear them out, and have the level of skepticism that would be appropriate given whatever you think their motivation biases are.
Yeah. Even the people that are helping you now.
Right.
How do you handle, there's always agenda-driven people who really want to help, but they're trying to be too helpful.
Right.
How do you manage the overly helpful?
Well, I think oftentimes with the people who want to be too helpful is make sure they understand that you don't want them to do anything. So that they don't walk away thinking they're your agent and they should go run around collecting evidence or taking other action. That's the last thing you obviously would want someone to do, unless you've got control and you really have thought it through and you want them to do something. So I think you got to be mindful of that with someone who wants to be really helpful. And then I think you've got to, again, have that appropriate skepticism and understand, why do they want to be so helpful? What is it? Are they just good citizens, good corporate citizens, good citizens generally? They want to come in, they want to report wrongdoing, they want to help the organization. Or is there something else there that they want to play junior G-man or a junior cop or whatever, what's really going on there and understanding that. I think it's critical to understand what that motivation is.
And then one last sort of investigation interviewing question is, what do you do when somebody comes in the door and says they've got valuable information, but they want a quid pro quo, whether it's they want to pass or they're angling for something else? I mean, I can see it happening. Any type of organization, somebody thinks this is the way they can get leverage.
Right. And that's a challenge. People will come in with various demands. It may be personal to them. They want some promotion or some other opportunity. We obviously are not management, so we can't bargain with them on that, those kinds of things. It may be something about, and this is frequently the case, concerns about anonymity and preserving anonymity, and making sure that they're distanced from whatever they're about to tell us. Other times it may be they did something wrong and they know they've got an issue with the organization, or they either know that we're on the heels, we're on their track and they're on the heels of getting in trouble, or they're trying to stay one step ahead of it because they figure out we're going to eventually figure it out. And with those people, you're going to have to talk them through. You can't make a deal with them without knowing what it is they did, or you shouldn't, in my view, make a deal with them without knowing what it is they did, so that you can fully assess the situation and decide what would be an appropriate way to address whatever the issue is that they're looking for help with. Because there are many things that can cause your investigation to lose credibility, but one of them is certainly treating someone who ended up doing the most wrong or among the greatest harm through whatever wrongdoing occurred, and having that person have no consequences, no accountability for what they did, while others lower down find the hammer dropping on them.
This concludes part one of our podcast with Michael Horowitz. I hope we were able to expand your compliance perspectives.